Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's off today. On this day before Thanksgiving, while we're thinking about food, we thought it might be fun to trace the history of American cuisine over the last 50 years and the changes we've seen since the counterculture not only challenged the political establishment in the 60s and 70s, but also the way Americans were eating at the time. Heading into the 60s, a lot of food came in cans and boxes. Frozen dinners were popular. Fresh wasn't emphasized, and organic, largely unheard of. Flash forward to today, when the Thanksgiving table might well feature a tofurkey or other vegetarian centerpiece. How did this food revolution come about? Food writer Jonathan Kaufman is author of Hippie Food, How the Back-to-Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And he joins us this hour for Radio Times. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
And entrepreneur and activist Judy Wicks is with us as well. Judy Wicks founded the White Dog Cafe and, among other things, is founder of the Sustainable Business Network of Greater Philadelphia. Hello, Judy. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary.
And here's the number to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Jonathan, first to you, let's begin with a bit of your background. You grew up in a Mennonite community in Indiana in the 70s. Pennsylvania Dutch fare was the norm in that area, but you say you ate hippie food as a kid.
That's right. My parents weren't anything close to what you'd call hippies, but they weren't necessarily conservative Mennonites as well. We belonged to a very liberal Mennonite church. But there was this cookbook that came out in 1976 called More with Less, and it combined, brought together recipes from a lot of Mennonites who had done relief work in other parts of the world, and combined it with this, you know, these sort of ideas around eating whole foods and eating simply, and created this cuisine that you know, all of my friends and I were eating, and I really didn't realize, you know, that it was such a rare thing until, you know, dealt with folks from school who were eating peanut butter jelly sandwiches and not three bean salads.
Yeah. And Judy, you say that your mom was an Adele Davis fan. She was kind of, a revolutionary, considered in some circles to be a revolutionary nutritionist at the time.
Yes. I can remember her often looking at these books. I think it was Eat Well to Be Well or something like that. I can't remember exactly now, but my mom was very much into healthy food, and both my parents had a large vegetable garden, and my mother used to, along with my grandmother, preserve foods for the winter, and our storage room would be full of jars of stewed tomatoes and all kinds of sauces, and the freezer full of vegetables from our garden. My grandmother would make pies as each season came in, the peaches, the cherries, so on. Rhubarb was first, then strawberry. I remember that. And then I would be able to eat them all year round because she would freeze them.
So. It all sounds delicious.
Yeah, it does. Just talking about it makes me hungry.
But at the time, Jonathan, you picked up a 1963 edition of the Good Housekeeping Cookbook and found, you know, the majority of recipes relied on boxes and tins, which was the result of another sort of revolution.
Yeah. After World War II, the American agriculture system went through a massive shift where they began relying on mechanization and on chemicals, both, you know, chemical fertilizers as well as pesticides and herbicides and, you know, fungicides. And also I think the American food industry introduced hundreds of new chemicals in food processing during the 1950s, you know, anything from preservatives to food coloring.
What made some in the young generation at the time in the 60s, as you write, want to strip their cuisine back to its pre-industrial roots?
I think it was a combination of factors. One was certainly the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement before it, which convinced a lot of young Americans that you know, what they were hearing from the government and what they were hearing from industry was totally wrong, and that in fact they really needed to question everything. There was that, you know, that phrase, question authority, and they also, as the first generation to grow up on this diet of all of this boxed and canned and processed, you know, chemical-laden food, grew up with a whole with a number of scandals that came out in the news about the effects of, you know, the possible problems with all these chemicals. And the most notable of those was 1962's Silent Spring, yeah, which Rachel Carson's expose about the dangers of DDT, which was the most widely used pesticide at the time. So I think this sort of in wanting to change everything that they were doing and being sort of disillusioned with the political process, they turned to changing the way they lived, and that meant creating new ways of living together and new economies, but also new ways of eating.
What was your sense of Silent Spring, Judy Wicks, and what was going on with pesticides, the use of pesticides at the time in the 60s?
Well, yeah, so Rachel Carson sort of painstakingly compiled all of these reports about DDT, you know, DDT use and its effect on the local sort of flora and fauna, and she was able to demonstrate that, you know, that this poisoning was moving its way up the food chain. It wasn't just affecting insects, but it was affecting all the animals that lived, you know, that sort of fed on them, and also, you know, worrying that this was having a direct effect on human health as well, since we were consuming a lot of this food as well.
Yeah, and Judy, what's your take on what was going on at the time?
Well, I think that's definitely true about the pesticides and so on. But the other thing I think that was a big factor was globalization, where the federal Department of Agriculture was directing farmers to plant in monocrops, fence post to fence post, and getting rid of all the trees, basically, and the wildlife and the wild areas around the farms, and planting everything in a monocrop for export. And that totally changed everything. Not only was it poisonous food, but it was monocrops that were terrible for the soil, and, you know, really created supply chains that were global, where places that were actually in farm country had a hard time finding local fresh food, because it was all in a system where it was harvested and shipped out of the community. So the diversified farming that we all relied on in the old days, where farmers planted many different crops for local consumption, and mixed that with raising animals and so on, was really destroyed, which also destroyed the rural communities at the same time.
So I'd like to get to farming and organic farming in just a bit, but focusing attention to food and actually the flavor of the culture at the time. It was a tough period in American history, enormous turbulence, violence. It was also, the counterculture was very colorful. Jonathan, you write, you quote Life magazine regarding a snapshot of life on the Sunset Strip circa 1966. I don't know if you have that passage at your fingertips there. If you don't,
I do.
It was
quite a remarkable one. And this is from an article, you know, sort of a Life writer when it embedded himself with teenagers hanging out around the Sunset Strip in L.A. The whole strip is throbbing, wailing, putting out the high tension, the big beat, hundreds of big beats from the engines and radios and wheels and coming from the open bars of clubs and discotheques. There are kids in chrome-plated Nazi helmets, anti-war buttons and Maltese crosses. There are surf kids, kids from poor homes, rich homes and no homes, thousands of kids. Negro boys wear blonde wigs. Girls are in boots or their bare feet. Shoulder-length hair is for everybody, along with little old lady sunglasses, ruffled bell-bottom pants, bullfighter jackets, pirate costumes, the ultimate in rebellion fashion.
And you have some really notable personalities who emerge on the food scene at that time. Jim Baker, in his middle age, renames himself Father Yod, and whose followers and many wives all bore the last name Aquarian. He ran an enormously successful restaurant called The Source, whose foods were simple, vegetarian, colorful, vibrant. Tell us a little bit more about this, Jonathan, and how we might see The Source's influence in today's cuisine.
So the reason I got interested in Father Yod and the Source family wasn't just because there's a documentary out about them that's a fantastic one, you should look it up, but they were really a pipeline between these older ideas around health food that kind of were centered in Southern California, that were focused on vitality and, you know, definitely on whole wheat, but they introduced things like sprouts and wheat germ and nutritional yeast to the diet. But Father Yod well, Jim Baker had operated a restaurant in that sort of health food vein and got caught up in the counterculture and caught up in a mysticism. And he opened this restaurant and formed a cult at the very same time. And so he had a couple hundred kids who were living with him, and they were all living in a big house and working for free at this restaurant, which was attracting like all the big stars. But what was also fascinating about this food, this very simple, fresh food, was that, you know, it set the template also for foods that got adopted, you know, in the middle of the country as well. Things like carrot juices and smoothies and, you know, things like, products like wheat germ and nutritional yeast. All of those made their way out from L.A. and from California across the country as people, you know, sort of tried to figure out what to eat that wasn't this plastic industrialized food.
And Judy, I don't know if this is your experience, but my understanding is that the early iterations of this cuisine were kind of blah and brown and dull and not very tasty. What do you think?
I kind of think of it that way, too. granola, oatmeal, those kinds of things seem kind of blah. But I wanted to pick up on that idea of rebelliousness, because I do think that affected our cuisine. Up until the 60s, or maybe more like the 70s or 80s, our cuisines were very separate. There was Italian cuisine, there was French cuisine, there was Chinese cuisine, and so on. And I think of Alice Waters as kind of leading the charge in terms of the new American cuisine. But it really took aspects of different cultures that really make up the U.S. culture, where the soup pot or whatever you want to call it of many cuisines. And so, rather than being strictly a classic Italian restaurants, for instance, or strictly a French classic, chefs started mixing together, and it was in a sense a kind of a rebellion against classic cuisine to do whatever you felt like doing, to mix, just like the costumes Jonathan was mentioning earlier. That was kind of like what the cuisine became, you know, of mixing different things.
But fresh things. Things were not canned and
boxed. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fresh things. But the character, the style of the cuisine was also a rebellion, against the classic cuisines.
We are talking today about America's modern mainstream foods, which were born of the counterculture of the 1960s. We're taking a look at how the 1960s and the 70s impact what we eat today, as well as our attitudes about food, ethics, health, and industrialized farming. Our guests this hour, Judy Wicks, a local activist, entrepreneur, and founder of the White Dog Cafe. Also, Jonathan Kaufman, food writer and author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We've got some colorful stories ahead as well, so stick with us. Should be a fun hour. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Marty Moscowane has the day off today, and we're taking a look at how today's foods have been impacted by changes in the counterculture of the 1960s and 1970s. Jonathan Kaufman is with us. He is a food writer and author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And Judy Wicks is founder of the White Dog Cafe and also co-founder of the Nationwide Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. She is an activist. 888-477-9499 is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also send an email to Radio Times at WHYY.org. So let's go back a number of decades and take a look at the macrobiotics movement in this country, founded by a gentleman named George Osawa. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Jonathan. But you describe him as a slim, almost gaunt man of 66 whose features were obscured by thick black glasses and a smile that cast ripples all the way up to his forehead. He arrives in America in the late 50s to lecture, and if I'm understanding this correctly, he survived some really terrible physical ailments, but he's obviously recovered. He exudes energy to lecture about the principles of macrobiotics. So just a briefly primer on that, if you would.
So George Osawa developed his ideas around nutrition from this Japanese movement, a very fringe Japanese movement that was trying to get the Japanese to return to a pre-Western contact diet, and arguing that all of their traditional foods like brown rice, tofu, miso were much healthier for you know, the Japanese, and that if they were eating too much processed food and sugar and meat, and that was really destroying their health. So he combined those ideas, which now seem very prescient, with his interpretation of traditional Chinese notions of yin and yang. And so he labeled certain foods yin and certain foods yang, and said that if you were balancing those foods in your diet, you would balance, you know, not just your body, but your alignment with the universe. And so he came to United States and started presenting this message, and it was unlike anything anybody had heard. He was saying that heart disease, diabetes, obesity, cancer were all caused by our diet, which is not something you were really hearing from academic nutritionists. But then he combined it with this sort of his very skewed idea of what you should be eating, and he was telling people that they should eat, you know, if they ate nothing but brown rice and a little miso soup for 10 days, they could, you know, totally cure every illness in their body.
Well, macrobiotics, when done incorrectly, could prove to be dangerous and even deadly.
Yeah, the hippie kids who took up this diet because they were interested in the almost the psychedelic way that he phrased the changes that they could, you know, bring about, they would push this 10-day rice diet to 30, 40, 50 days, and people developed scurvy, and some people even died.
It totally knocked the four food groups approach on its head.
Yes, it did. Yeah. I mean, you know, his idea was that every meal should be centered around your principal grain, and that should be unrefined rice or oats, and that you shouldn't eat much meat at all. It was too yang, and so you should really maybe have a little bit of fish. So and no fruit and no sugar and no baked products.
No fruit. Okay.
No fruit.
So, Judy, what are we, you know, I'm not sure if you have this information at your fingertips, but are we seeing this influence in restaurants today, a macrobiotic influence?
I don't see that. I think one thing that maybe came from that, although I'm not sure historically, is no dairy. And mm-hmm. that has really taken off. I think that people are beginning to realize that adult human beings were not meant to consume large quantities of milk that was made by nature to feed young baby calves. And, you know, I think it's been pretty well established that dairy causes a lot of health ailments, but the dairy business is the industry is very strong. So it's hard to speak out about it. Not for me, but I mean, you know, you don't hear it's not mainstream. But I see a lot of people giving up dairy for health reasons. Large quantities of meat and meat that's raised in the industrial way, where the beef is fed, the cows are fed grains, which make the meat marbly, and that's supposed to make it superior. And we're encouraged by propaganda to eat meat that's marbly from the fat, but that's actually also very harmful. And I think the roots of these, you know, come from this Eastern way of eating.
So Jonathan, to conclude this story, how long did George Osawa live, and did he live a long and healthy life on this macrobiotic diet, which we assume he practiced?
Unfortunately, George Osawa died pretty early. Just as the movement was getting off in America, he died of, I think it was heart failure. He was maybe 70. But his main disciple in America, Michio Kushi, just passed away within the past year or two at the age of 90-something. And he drew a crowd of people to Boston, he and his wife, Aveline, and they published cookbooks and taught classes and kind of removed, sanded off the excesses of George Osawa's talks to make it a slightly more logical diet, if still bland.
Let's get to some comments. We've got a question from Silvio, who says, I'm a big fan of the White Dog Cafe. Please ask Judy what the inspiration was for the White Dog to focus strictly on American food and where she sees the next evolution in food going.
Gee, well, I wanted to have an American restaurant because I had just run a French restaurant for 10 years with all those heavy sauces, you know, Bernays and Hollandaise and so on. And I was really inspired by my parents' vegetable garden. And at the time, there was no such thing as American cuisine. That was hamburgers or steak and potatoes or whatever. So I hadn't heard of Alice Waters or the new American cuisine. I just wanted to cook food like my mother did, that was healthy and directly from the farms. That was the most important thing to me, is to buy fresh local food.
And that wasn't being done at the time.
It wasn't being done at the time. This was 1983. And then, lo and behold, not long after I opened the White Dog and started, there was a Newsweek or Time magazine article about Alice Waters and the new American cuisine. So I kind of caught that wave of interest in what's now called farm-to-table restaurants. But there wasn't a name to it at the time. But I think it was a rebellion in a sense against the classic cuisines. And I remember one time we were in the Soviet Union. We had an international sister restaurant at the White Dog. And the Soviets' way of cooking was to replicate the great chefs. You know, so the recipe had to be exactly as it had been done for the last 100 years. And so the big challenge was finding the ingredients. So I brought my chef and pastry chef over there to cook an American dinner in the Soviet Union, and they kept asking, well, what ingredients do you need? We said, you know, don't worry about it. You know, we'll just figure it out when we get there. And they were hysterical about this and worried because, you know, that's not the way they worked. And we just went and saw what was at the marketplace and cooked something around that. And so that is we realized the difference between the classic European cuisines and the new American was that we didn't start with a recipe. We started with what is fresh and local from the farm, and then you create a dish from that. And so they understood that. They came here and saw what we did, and then they named a dish after me, Chicken Judy. So that was a great honor to have a dish named after me in the Soviet Union.
Was it really hard to get the farm-to-table system set up here in the early 80s? I mean, it was unheard of, and were you kind of getting pushback from the regular industrialized farming sector?
It was hard in a way. It was most hard for the chef. And I lured Aliza Green. She was a chef down in Center City, and I was a little unknown joint in West Philly. But she was buying from local farmers, and I loved her cuisine, which was, I think, somewhat influenced by Alice Waters. And so I knew she was pregnant, and so I said if she came to be the chef at the White Dog, I would set up a room for her babysitter and her baby so that she could constantly see her child and be able to breastfeed while she was working. So she went for that.
That was revolutionary, too.
Exactly. Yeah. And so she was our chef for the first year, and she really I spoke earlier about how the new American cuisine pulls influences from different cultures that we're a melting pot of, and she called that cuisine mongrel, mongrel food.
we've got the dog.
We got the dog thing going here.
So, Jonathan, let's get to bread. Prior to the '60s, if there was bread on the table, it was likely white. What does whole wheat flour have that white flour doesn't? And why does white bread appeal so much?
So, yeah, by the 1960s and 70s, there was almost no whole wheat bread on the shelves. In the 1800s, there was a revolution in milling. So the wheat kernel is made of, there's the endosperm and the germ, which are the sort of the soft, white, starchy parts with some protein. And then there's the bran and the hull. And the bran has all of, it's the sort of hard, you know, papery, plasticky, covering of the, and it has all of the nutrients, all the vitamins that you would get in the grain, but it also has a lot of oils, so it spoils fast. So there was this revolution where they stopped grinding it through between two stones and started pressing it in these roller mills, which produced this fine, white, delicate flour that you could make these beautiful croissants and baguette and, you know, sort of fluffy white breads with, but they also had no nutritional value, basically.
Yeah. But early iterations of efforts to change this and to add more nutrition back into breads were not real appealing?
Well,
they were rather crunchy.
Because brown bread is darker, earthier, chewier, maybe it wasn't quite as appealing to folks, or at least it didn't have as good a marketing approach. The thing that nutritionists were able to convince the government to do, which was to demand that enrichment of flour happen, so bringing a few vitamins back into this white flour, which actually ended up solving a pellagra epidemic down south, because of vitamin deficiency.
Interesting. So, and in another note, you tell the story of an ordained Presbyterian minister, Sylvester Graham, who proselytizes about vegetarianism and, in his opinion, the horrors of commercial white bread. Even though his lecturing career, I think, lasted, a decade, his influence persisted.
Yeah, Sylvester Graham, he was traveling up and down the Northeast in the 1830s, and he was the first anti-industrial food sort of critic, in the sense that this brown bread, he wanted it to be made, milled and made at home. And he distrusted millers and how they might be adulterating this flour as they were making this white flour. And in fact, there was a group outside one of his lectures, a group of them protested. There was all a riot, and he also, he had to be snuck out. But he also argued that vegetarian food, he argued that meat, sugar, spice, coffee, tea would overexcite the senses, and the more our senses, our nerves got overexcited, the weaker and the more debilitated we would be. So that's how he sort of practiced this very abstemious vegetarian diet that was picked up by the Seventh-day Adventists afterwards. But the food, we know him because, this flour, this earthy brown whole wheat flour, came to be known as Graham flour, and then they named Graham crackers after him as well.
There you go. Well, I'd like to pick up on a point you kind of alluded to earlier. Let's talk about the food movement as a whole. It was primarily white during the countercultural times. Is that correct?
This kind of food, this sort of earthy, hippie food, that was spread through food co-ops a lot, and communes and organic farms, was really a little overwhelmingly white in most parts of the country. And I think it was because counterculture folks didn't really have a lot of sense about how to bring in communities of color, they wanted to bring healthy food to the masses, but they didn't necessarily know how to bring people of color into their institutions. There were a few pockets where they were talking about race and access and class, notably the Bay Area, which was really influenced by the Black Panthers. But in too many other communities that I was studying, I would say, hey, were there folks of color that I can talk to who were part of these institutions? They were like, no, they just weren't coming to our store, or they weren't coming to our, they weren't joining our groups.
Well, and you also write of, in an important note, Elijah Muhammad, who is leader of the Black Muslim group, he took aim at many of the southern staples that we know as soul food.
Yeah. So there was out of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam was producing one of the most interesting critiques of the food system out there, even though a lot of it was framed in ways that, you shouldn't eat pork, you shouldn't eat certain vegetables, you could only eat bread if it was toasted. But what he was saying was that, the white economy, the white food system is poisoning us. And so we, as members of the African American community, need to form our own bakeries. We need to cook our own food, and we need to, make our own money. So that's how your Black Muslim bakery, the chain of your Black Muslim bakeries, opened up around the United States.
Flash forward to 2018, Judy Wicks, much different picture, much more inclusion, much more diversity in fresh foods movements.
Yes, but more work needs to be done. I do think that, at least in Philadelphia, that farmers markets are now easily accessible in most every inner city community. There are programs that teach mothers how to cook from scratch. But I think that the public school system has pretty terrible food, and so young people in the public school systems are introduced to a lot of junk food, really. I know Michelle Obama tried to change that, and there was a pushback. But I think we need to have our school children should eat the best possible food possible and learn at early age to appreciate, you know, fruits and vegetables and so on. And, you know, I know in other cultures, like in France, they feed their school children as though they were in a five-star hotel or something, you know, with these beautiful cheeses and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think we start kids off on the wrong track in our public school system.
Is it because it's more expensive to bring fresh fruits, fresh vegetables?
Yes.
Fresh meats?
Because it needs to be cooked. I think oftentimes this food is shipped from some place like Chicago that's frozen in these little, like TV dinners kind of a thing. It's cheap, yeah. And our public schools are underfunded, and that's one of the ways they cut corners. It just leads into the whole disgrace in our whole country that we don't value the health and well-being of all the children in our country by feeding them well.
We've got some comments coming in. In the 70s, this is a tweet, it was difficult to get sprouts, etc. I spent time down on South Street shopping at, quote, health food, end quote, stores. Finding the good food I enjoy is definitely easier now. Lois tweets, I moved to a commune in 1970 where we were growing most of our vegetables and driving to Arkansas to buy Lundberg rice in bulk. This way of eating made much sense to me, both nutritionally and ecologically. You've heard of Lundberg rice, Jonathan?
Yeah, I got to talk to the Lundbergs. In fact, they play a pretty big role in my chapter about macrobiotics, because they were convinced to start growing organic brown rice in this tiny town in California in 1970 by the macrobiotic folks.
Interesting. And then a comment from Betty. Our rule in the 70s was, if you can't pronounce it, you shouldn't eat it. All right, on that thought, we'll get to our break here on Radio Times. More to come in just about a minute and a half. Our guests, Jonathan Kaufman, food writer and author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And Judy Wicks is a local activist, entrepreneur, and founder of the White Dog Cafe. If you'd like to reach out, the number is 888-477-9499, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. More in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and the topic this hour is, well, let's say, what's on the Thanksgiving table, and what on that table might hark back to, might have its origins in the 1960s and the 1970s, and the counterculture and the revolution, which not only worked against the political establishment at the time, but against the way Americans were eating. Our guest this hour, Judy Wicks, is an entrepreneur and activist and founder of the White Dog Cafe. And Jonathan Kaufman is a food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's the author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. So early in the show, I mentioned that perhaps somebody might have a tofurkey as the centerpiece of the Thanksgiving table tomorrow. Jonathan, there certainly wasn't, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, the plethora of meatless products that there is now. John Harvey Kellogg of Kellogg Cereal fame came up with some of the first meat analogs, Protos and, is it Nuttos or Nutos?
Nuttos, yeah.
Nuttos,
I guess.
Were they edible? Let's talk about the evolution there.
I mean, you could talk to older Seventh-day Adventists, and they reminisce about them fondly, but they were a combination of nuts or peanuts and wheat gluten, so it doesn't seem that appealing to me.
Nor to many of us, I'm sure, although some people certainly embrace them. So flash forward to today. What might we see on the Thanksgiving table that has its roots, if you will, back to the 60s and 70s? Jonathan?
Let's see. Well, you'll definitely, you know, you'll probably see some, you might see some local vegetables, local seasonal vegetables. You might see some wild rice from Minnesota, which sort of was made its way through the natural food stores into restaurants in the 1980s. But, you know, if you have a vegetarian family, you'll definitely see, you'll probably see a tofurkey. And the tofurkey definitely came out of the 1970s natural food movement. Mm-hmm.
Judy, you say a localized economy makes communities more resilient, more self-reliant, and it creates meaningful local jobs.
Absolutely. I think that in this time of climate change, that it's really about our survival. building sustainable local economies where we produce our basic needs locally, not only food, but fiber and energy. It really not only reduces the carbons of long-distance shipping, but it also fortifies our communities to have our basic needs produced locally, because we don't know what all is coming with climate change, but we know it's going to be hard and that we can't rely on shipping food into our communities. We need to grow it here. So it's really imperative that we support our local farmers and that we grow a strong local food system that can support our region.
Back to the phones. Nate has been hanging on for quite a while. So, Nate, we thank you for that. And I understand you run a farming nonprofit in New Jersey?
I do, yes. I'm Nate Kleinman. I run a group called the Experimental Farm Network out of Elmer, New Jersey. Actually, we're based in Philadelphia. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and we had wheat germ in the cupboard and quinoa and before those things were as available. And my mom was into macrobiotic, and we had moosewood on the shelf, and but I still ate a lot of terrible food growing up, like most Americans, fried chicken and pizza and all kinds of foods like that. And my real impulse to eat healthy was when I started cooking for myself in college. And I think a lot of people, their health is a first impulse. But I really want to thank Judy for bringing up that point about climate change. That's the work that my nonprofit does. We try and get people collaborating on projects to work on developing new perennial grains, perennial oil seeds, perennial vegetables, the kind of crops that we could use to actually fight climate change and to replace our industrial farming system, which is really a major driver of climate change. And I'm optimistic that with the crisis that's happening now in modern farming, exacerbated by these tariffs from the Trump administration, I think there's a real I hope that there's going to be a real impulse among farmers to switch to more sustainable methods. There are
I'm going to have to jump in there, Nate. Thank you so much for the call. Judy, do you have any thoughts? Reactions to what Nate has said about climate change and sustainability.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. I totally agree with what he's saying. I'm glad to hear that he's working on this. I'd like to get his contact information so we can talk later, because I do think it is about our survival and in the face of climate change that we change the way we grow food closer to home and more perennial grasses more heritage breed animals that can, talk about the Thanksgiving table. To me, one of the most important things is having a heritage breed turkey as opposed to those produced in the industrial system.
Why?
It's a breed that can survive in out of doors in different climates and so on because they've survived that in the past. They taste much, much better. They're raised with respect and kindness in places where they are allowed to act like turkeys and forage on the pasture and so on as opposed to growing up in factories. So for ethical reasons as well as health reasons and as well as our future, that we need animals that are raised on pasture.
Jonathan, do you see any parallels between the counterculture movement of the 60s and, say, organic farming with what is happening today among the younger generation and the issue of climate change?
I feel like the critique that was developed in the 1960s and 70s of the industrialized food system is as timely and as urgent as it was back then. I think climate change wasn't something that folks were talking about, but they were talking about large-scale farming and large-scale meat production and how that was really contributing to, a whole host of both personal health issues and as well as environmental issues.
We've got a question from Harriet who asks, my main concern with the food supply is the excess of sugar. I was born in the 1940s, and when I was growing up, we'd eat things like cream of wheat. Now there's sugar cereal. What are your guests' thoughts on that? And before we started the show, Judy, you and I were chatting about Adele Davis and how, her books were in my household growing up. She attacked the issue of refined sugar decades ago, and yet it's still very much a part of our culture.
It sure is. And you know, I think it's one of these things that we're brainwashed about, and a lot of the processed foods have a high level of sugar in it. When I taste processed food, I think, oh my God, this is just either too salty or too sugary. And it is the white poison, a lot of people call it, sugar. And yet we're so conditioned as children to eat sweet foods that we crave sugar. So I think it's a real problem, and I agree with the caller that we need to eat a lot less sugar. And luckily now there's a lot of sugar substitutes like stevia, which is perfectly natural and not at least a bit harmful and sweet. Dates, and there's many ways to sweeten foods without using processed white sugar.
Mm. Jonathan, tell us a bit about sugar and the way it was viewed back in the 60s. I mean, again, that's one of those attempts during the counterculture movement to address the negatives about white sugar, but it didn't quite make it.
Yeah, well, it didn't. I mean, and it didn't change that we didn't sort of remove all the processed foods from the food system. And I agree, the more processed foods are available, the more sugar people are eating. And what they did do was the counterculture kids really worked on a they sort of adopted a critique of white sugar that really looked at its history and how a lot of sugar production was tied to the slave trade, as well as, its effect on our health. And they developed all of these recipes that worked with alternative sugars, such as maple syrup, honey.
Mm-hmm.
raw sugar, how that could possibly be better for us than this sort of white sugar.
Let's take a...
And those methods and those ingredients are definitely still around.
All right. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jonathan Kaufman is author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And Judy Wicks is founder of the White Dog Cafe, a Philadelphia restaurant which focuses on serving fresh local food long before it was popular. It was founded back in 1983. Again, you write a lot of interesting and entertaining anecdotes about the 60s and the way some of the young people operated back in the day, Jonathan. Some of them published and opened businesses and, of course, did things their own unique way. In your research, you encountered a grocery in Austin, which had a rather interesting method of accounting.
Uh-huh.
By the phases of the moon.
There were. It was a very creative time, and I think people were open to anything and living as colorfully as possible, and being as anti-capitalist as a lot of the food co-ops were. They tried a lot of different ways of making these businesses work.
And they didn't need the internet to spread the word. Tell us about that.
No, one of my major questions was, how did this diet spread all across the country so quickly in the matter of a few years without the internet? And talking to people, what just became clear is that this was counterculture kids were mobile. They would travel to San Francisco for a few weeks and then go to Austin and hang out in Boston. And people were so mobile, and they were talking so much about these ideas that it was all word of mouth.
But it was centered, really, the evolution of this movement was centered in California, San Francisco, but L.A. in particular. Why was L.A. so well-suited to the health food movement?
L.A. was a destination for health seekers back in the late 1800s and early 1900s when the railroad arrived there. And so there were all these tuberculosis sufferers who moved out there. And then you add in the film industry, 30 years later, and you get this huge influx of people who are, fascinated with health and wellness and beauty and combining all the two of them. And they that's where, that was the broadcast entertainment center. And so they had radio shows and books and TV shows like Jack LaLanne. And so they got their ideas out there.
Mm. Fast forward to this day and age and modern activism. And Judy, a couple of years ago, you went to Standing Rock in North Dakota to cook for hundreds of Native Americans who call themselves water protectors as opposed to protesters. And this was for Thanksgiving, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were taking a stand against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is now in operation. But tell us about that. What did that operation involve?
Well, we ended up... In the beginning, I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner for 200 water protectors, but by the end of the project, it was 2,000 because we combined forces with another group out there and served in the high school auditorium. But for 20 years at the White Dog, I used to have a Native American Thanksgiving dinner, and it was a time when we gave thanks to Native Americans for the many things in our diet that were cultivated by Native people before the colonists arrived, corn and potatoes and squash, and they were the ones that domesticated the turkey, for instance, cranberries. Almost everything on our Thanksgiving table was first cultivated by Native Americans, and it wasn't like it was growing wild there. It was cultivated by Native people, and it really kept alive the colonists. And so I wanted to do this for several reasons. One, to give thanks to Native people for what they've done historically, and also with our food, but also to thank them for protecting Mother Earth, because they were taking a stand against the fossil fuel industry to protect their water and their land and their culture from fossil fuels. And it was very impactful to be there. And also what the Native people said, that it's not so much what they're against, but what they're for. And they are for localized food systems and localized sustainable energy. They are great leaders. I think we can look to indigenous people for the way out of the mess that we're in right now.
Let's get in one more question. This is from Dominic. He says he's 83 years old. His father was on a health kick in the 1940s. We ate whole wheat bread, Dominic says, raw honey, plenty of fruits and veggies, and got milk from the farmer. Did this food movement maybe start earlier in some places? Jonathan?
Oh, I think it definitely did. The roots of it, date back to the 1800s, but also there was this health food movement and folks like Adele Davis who were promoting a lot of these ideas. But it really was a pretty fringe until the fringe, I guess the counterculture, picked it up. And what they did wasn't just sort of spread these ideas but they published cookbooks and they founded thousands of food co-ops. And they really brought a lot of these ideas about food to the mainstream.
So what's next in the food movement? Where do we go next from here? What still needs to be done in terms of activism to make our food supply healthier and to get more people on board with eating healthfully? Judy Wicks?
Well, one thing for sure is that there now are a plethora of farm markets where we can get fresh local food. But I think what's next is to have more processing of those local foods into products that we can eat year-round, so that when we go into a grocery store, it's not just the fresh section that's local, but also the middle aisles, instead of all this processed industrial processed food, to have small local entrepreneurs that make our products that we can eat year-round. So one of the things that I'm working on now, I have a microloan fund called the Circle of Aunts and Uncles, and we provide low-interest loans of 3% loans of up to $12,000 for entrepreneurs that are working to build our local economy. And most of them are food entrepreneurs. So we have a butcher, a baker, and three ice cream makers, for instance, and they all buy from local farms. So that's what we need to do is to and what the public can do is to buy local, not just the farmers markets, but to look for locally made ice cream, local butchers who buy from farms, grass-fed beef and so on.
And Jonathan, in 10, 15 seconds, where do you think this is heading?
I'm really heartened by the discussion around how we need to eat less meat and how meat production, I'm an omnivore, but meat production is really responsible for a lot of environmental climate change. And so if we change the subsidy system from the USDA, we can really change the focus from meat production to more healthy foods like grains and vegetables.
Jonathan Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us. Jonathan is author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Judy Wicks as well. A pleasure to have you here.
Great to be here.
Judy Wicks is an entrepreneur, activist, and founder of the White Dog Cafe. As always, we invite you to follow us at Radio Times, whyy.org/Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer, producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Have a great Thanksgiving.